Today on Against the Grain, as COVID tragically illustrated, large numbers of Americans are in poor health and especially vulnerable to viruses and other pathogens. How did we get here? According to physician Robert Lustig, it started with a turn toward processed food, which has led to an ongoing national and global public health crisis while enriching corporations and the U.S. government. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While the United States is an affluent society, much of its population is chronically ill. Robert Lustig is Emeritus Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology at UCSF, known for such books as The Hacking of the American Mind. In his latest book, Metabolical, The Lure and Lies of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine, Lustig looks at the connection between chronic illness and the widespread consumption of processed food. When I spoke to him recently, I put this question to him. Over the last 50 years, we've seen the growth of chronic diseases such as diabetes, autoimmune illness, and heart disease. How marked has that increase been?
So when I entered medical school in 1976, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes in the adult population over age 65 was 2.5%. The prevalence of type 2 diabetes in the population under age 65 was about 0.5%. So type 2 diabetes was a relatively rare phenomenon back then. Today, the prevalence of type 2 diabetes in America over age 20 is 9.4% for the entire group. So we have more than quadrupled our prevalence. There's a new disease that we never even heard of before called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So in 1976, if you had fat in your liver, you were an alcoholic. But today, 45% of Americans have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and 25% of children, this is a disease they'd never seen before. And remember, children don't drink alcohol, at least most of them. So we now have the basically pandemic of chronic metabolic disease throughout our entire society, reaching down into three-year-olds. We are the children are the canaries in the coal mine, and everyone's suffering.
So then what took place over the course of the past 50 years?
What's the cause of this? And the short answer is the transition of our diet from a, shall we say, ancestral diet, which was a real food diet, that is a low sugar, high fiber diet, to a Western diet, a processed food diet, a high sugar, low fiber diet, high sugar for palatability, low fiber for shelf life. So the food processing companies, and you know their names because they're the ones who can afford a logo, Kellogg's and PepsiCo and, you know, Coca-Cola and General Foods, and you know, going down the line, food processing works for them. And adding sugar increases sales, and reducing fiber increases shelf life. So this is, you know, their juggernaut. This is their money train. Prior to 1975, the annual profit margin for the food industry was 1% per year. Well, the increase in population was 1% per year. So what that meant was that prior to 1975, the food industry made more money by selling the same amount of food per person to more people. Since 1975, the annual profit margin of the food industry is 5% per year. But In fact, our birth rate has gone down. It is now less than 1% per year. It's about 0.85% per year. So in order for the food industry to be making five times as much, they have to be selling a whole lot more food per person to fewer people. So the question is, how'd they do that? They did that with the Western diet, because the Western diet is both toxic and addictive.
To what degree has this change, originating in the American food system, become a global problem?
It's everywhere. Because number one, it's tasty. Two, it's cool. Three, it's convenient. Four, it's subsidized and therefore cheap. And number five, storable. So the bottom line is any country that can revert to the Western diet has. And so we are seeing these same diseases play out all over the world. And while we're doing that, we're actually, you know, strafing the Amazon and, you know, contributing to climate change. So, you know, processed food is at the base of, you know, pretty much all of the current societal problems that the entire world is confronting.
Why is processed food so damaging? What is it about the processing of food? Because some people might say, well, isn't cooking some kind of processing? And what makes processed food fit that label?
That's a really good question. First, you have to know what the definition of food is. So I'm going to give you the definition right from the dictionary. Substrate that is utilized for either growth or burning of an organism. I accept that definition. That's a fine definition. Substrate that is used for either growth or burning of an organism. But what if a substrate actually inhibits burning? Turns out, the sweet molecule in sugar called fructose, the molecule we seek, the molecule that's addictive, that molecule actually inhibits mitochondrial function. It inhibits mitochondrial ATP generation, chemical energy formation that your cell needs to power itself to function. And it does it three different ways, three separate enzymes in mitochondria that are necessary to make mitochondria work. It inhibits an enzyme called AMP kinase, which is the fuel gauge on the cell that tells the cell how much energy is in it and tells the mitochondria to boost production. It inhibits an enzyme called ACADL, acyl-CoA dehydrogenase long chain, which is the first enzyme on the way to breaking up fatty acids for energy production. And lastly, it inhibits an enzyme called carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1, which is the enzyme that helps shuttle fatty acids into the mitochondria so that they can be burned in the first place. So, bottom line, sugar inhibits ATP generation. Sugar inhibits burning. And so, sugar doesn't actually contribute energy. It actually saps energy. Now, the food industry says, yeah, but sugar is 4 calories per gram. Who cares? If you're not making ATP, then it doesn't matter how much energy and heat is being given off when a fructose molecule is being burned in a bomb calorimeter. ATP is the currency of the cell, not heat. Second, growth. Well, my colleague, Dr. Efrat Monsonigo-Ornan, who is the chairman of nutrition at Hebrew University Jerusalem, just showed that ultra-processed food actually inhibits skeletal growth. You can actually see the bone and the wasting of the bone and the inability for cortical bone to be formed and the shortening of the bone due to ultra-processed food. And we also know that ultra-processed food hijacks the growth machinery of cells to increase cancer formation. So you're not growing, you're actually inhibiting growth or you're hijacking growth. So if a substrate does not contribute to growth, does not contribute to burning, but actually inhibits both of them, we would not call that a food. We would call that a poison. In fact, ultra-processed food is poison.
So let me see if I have that right. So one of the key processes in our bodies goes on in our cells with our mitochondria. If those are inhibited, we're not able to heal ourselves. It's damaging to our bodies. And you mentioned the role of sugar in that. And we're going to talk a lot more about sugar. But what if we put added sugar to the side just for a moment? If food is processed without sugar being added, is it still harmful? And if so, how?
Yes. So the other thing that's wrong with processed food is the lack of fiber. Now, people think fiber is what you throw in the garbage after you juice the fruit. You couldn't be further from the truth. Fiber is not food for you. Fiber is food for your bacteria. So you have 10 trillion cells in your body, but you have 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. Your bacteria actually outnumber you 10 to 1. Each of us is just a big bag of bacteria with legs. Now, it turns out those bacteria contribute to your health. They make chemicals that help you be healthy. They can also make chemicals that can make you be sick. And when you starve your bacteria, when you don't feed your bacteria feed on you. Turns out, those bacteria, if you don't give them what they need, they will strip the mucin layer, which is a protective layer, on the surface of your intestinal epithelial cells. They will strip it right off and use that for their food, thus exposing your intestinal epithelia, which are supposed to be behind this mucin layer so that they are protected. Now they are basically engulfed by bacteria, by cytokines, by lipopolysaccharides that are ultimately get through the intestine into your bloodstream, a process which we call leaky gut, which then end up at your liver and cause inflammation at the liver, driving chronic metabolic disease. So you have to feed your bacteria in order for you to be healthy. Well, processed food is fiberless food. They've taken the fiber out because you can't freeze fiber. I'll prove it to you. Take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight, take it out the next morning, let it thaw on the counter, try to eat it, see what you get. You get mush. Why do you get mush? Because the ice crystals macerated the cell wall of the fruit of each plant and allowed the water to rush in. Hey, food industry knows that. So what do? They squeeze it, they freeze it, frozen concentrated orange juice. They have turned a fruit, an orange, into a commodity. Frozen concentrated orange juice. You can sell it on the commodities exchange. And because it doesn't go bad as long as it stays frozen, okay, it can then be, you know, manipulated in terms of its price. This is the reason that various components of food, but not food itself, have reduced in terms of the consumer price index, whereas real food has continued to go up on the consumer price index. And so, in fact, sugar and processed food has a consumer price index of around 25, whereas real food has a consumer price index of about 150. So processed food gets cheaper. And of course, that makes it more saleable.
You've discussed the stripping out of fiber, the adding in of sugar. What about the use of high temperatures in the processing of food? Why is that so concerning to you?
If you've ever made a poor man's pudding, okay, you take a can of sweetened condensed milk and you put it in a pressure cooker and you turn up the heat and you let it sit there for about an hour under high pressure. And then you take the can out and you open up the can, and instead of a white material, you have a brown material. That brown, which, you know, has been caramelized, that caramelization reaction called the Maillard reaction actually causes damage. Because every time a glucose or a fructose links to a protein, which is what happens inside that can, you have released, you have, first of all, you have made that protein less flexible. You have caused dysfunction in that protein, and you have released a reactive oxygen species, a little hydrogen peroxide. Now, hydrogen peroxide is great if you're trying to clean a wound on your skin. It's not so great when you're making it inside your cells. And it's not so great when you're making it inside your food, because it turns out dietary advanced glycation end products, dietary AGEs, this browning stuff that's in our food because of high temperatures, actually binds to receptors called receptors for advanced glycation end products called RAGE, and that causes cellular dysfunction also. So even cooking can cause problems with food. And of course, the more carbohydrate, and certainly the more fructose, the greater the number of advanced glycation end products that will be formed. So yes, heating can be a problem. Various forms of cooking can be a problem. If you fry food and you bring the smoking point up too high and you end up burning the food, which happens relatively commonly, especially in commercial fryers, you will create various toxic products. You will create acrylamide when you put French fries, when you put carbohydrate into very hot oil. And all of these have detrimental effects on metabolism as well.
I'm speaking with Robert Lustig. He's a pediatric endocrinologist, the author of Metabolical, The Lure and Lies of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So some listeners might say, well, okay, processed food, I don't generally eat that stuff. I wouldn't touch Cheetos. So, you know, I eat organic. I buy my stuff at Whole Foods. I'm fine. What would your response be to that? Is there a spectrum of harm here from ultra-processed to processed? Would a cooked tomato sauce bought from the store pose problems if it didn't have sugar added?
So the question is, what's in tomato sauce? Tomatoes? Take a look at the label sometime. Well, first of all, you know, there's salt and there's citric acid. But, you know, the bottom line is they use immature tomatoes in tomato sauce, because if the tomatoes were mature, they'd sell them as tomatoes because they can make a lot more money on them. So the tomatoes that are used in tomato sauce, canned or jarred, is actually immature tomatoes, and they do have a lot of citric acid. And that citric acid is relatively bitter, kind of like vinegar. And so what they have to do is they have to offset that acidity. And so what do? They add sugar. So take a look at the amount of sugar that's added to your favorite tomato sauce. Guaranteed, it's pretty high. The only way to avoid that is to make your own tomato sauce. The bottom line is sugar sneaks in to all sorts of foods, in part because you have five tastes on your tongue. Sweet, right? That's salty, bitter, sour, and umami. Well, sweet covers up the other four. So it covers up salty, like honey roasted peanuts, covers up bitter, like milk chocolate, covers up sour, like lemonade, and it covers up umami, like sweet and sour pork. Bottom line is, you can make dog poop taste good with enough sugar, and the food industry does.
Well, let's talk more about sugar. You mentioned fructose. Can you break down for us for a moment how we should understand fructose in relationship to sugar? Is fructose the main culprit, that kind of sugar? Break it down for us, please.
Sure. Dietary sugar, sucrose, the stuff you put in your coffee, the white crystals, is made up of two molecules. One's called glucose, one's called fructose. And they are linked together, called an O-glycosidic linkage. Now, glucose is the energy of life. Every cell on the planet burns glucose for energy. Glucose is so important that if you don't consume it, your body makes it, a process called gluconeogenesis. So the Inuit, they didn't have any carbohydrate. They had ice. They didn't have any place to grow a strand of wheat. Okay? They had whale blubber, but they still had a serum glucose level. And the reason is because the whale blubber would go to the liver, and the liver would turn that whale blubber into glucose so that they had a serum glucose level. Everyone has a serum glucose level. The only way to not have a serum glucose level is to be dead. All right? But fructose is the other molecule. Now, fructose is not glucose. Glucose is a six-membered ring. Fructose is a five-membered ring. Glucose can be metabolized by all cells to produce energy. Fructose can only be metabolized by the liver to produce energy. Glucose stimulates mitochondrial function. Fructose, as I mentioned earlier, inhibits mitochondrial function. But glucose is not all that sweet. You know, you don't see people going around chugging Karo syrup, do you? Think of molasses, all right? Now, is molasses sweet? Yeah, it is. But, you know, it's, you know, maybe okay in a cookie, but you don't see people using it very much. It's got a very distinctive flavor. And, it, you know, sometimes it can actually be a little on the bitter side. But that's glucose. Molasses is glucose. Okay. Corn syrup before it's turned into high fructose corn syrup is glucose. Fructose, on the other hand, is very sweet. It is the molecule we seek. It is the molecule that the food industry uses very specifically to make its food tastier. Okay, and we have lots and lots of taste receptors on our tongue for fructose. Turns out fructose is metabolized completely differently from that of glucose. It can only be metabolized in the liver, and there's a limit to how much your liver can metabolize. The same way your liver has a limit to how much alcohol it can metabolize. So think of it as, well, if you have one drink a day, you're probably fine. If you have two drinks a day, depends if you're a woman or a man. If you have two drinks a day and you're a man, maybe you'll get away with it. If you have two drinks a day and you're a woman, probably you won't get away with it. If you have three drinks a day, you're going to be pretty tipsy. If you have four drinks a day, you're going to be on the floor. And if you have five drinks a day, you're a friggin' alcoholic. All right? Now, it's clearly dose dependent. A little is not a big problem, but clearly a lot is definitely a big problem. Well, fructose is the same thing. We have a limited capacity to metabolize this molecule called fructose. If you overwhelm your liver's capacity, your liver has no choice. It can't process all that fructose. And what it does is it turns that fructose into fat in the liver. Now, some of that fat will make its way out of the liver, and now you've got high triglycerides and risk for heart disease and obesity. Or that fat will precipitate in the liver. Now you've got a lipid droplet. Now you've got non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And now you have the setup for type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, and many other chronic metabolic diseases. This fat, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease that we've been talking about. So, bottom line, we are overdosed on this molecule that we have limited capacity to metabolize. And the food industry did it because we used to consume about 10 to 15 grams of sugar a day. We now have in our diet median 95 grams of sugar per day. And it used to be as high as 120 grams of sugar per day. It's come down because of the obesity epidemic. Point is, we're still about four times over our limit.
Well, I need to ask the question that some listeners are going to wonder, which is, does that mean avoiding fruit if you are to avoid fructose?
Everybody wants to know, what about fruit? Fruit has fructose, it does. Not that much. I mean, you know, there is fructose in fruit. That's why it's sweet, because the glucose doesn't really make it sweet. It's the fructose that makes it sweet. All right, so that's true. But the amount of fructose in any given piece of fruit is actually on the lowish side. And it comes with its antidote. It comes with fiber. So let's talk about fiber here for a minute. I've already told you that fiber is the food for your bacteria. But fiber is also the protection against sugar and starch and simple carbohydrates. So fiber, first of all, there are two kinds of fiber. There's fiber called soluble fiber, like pectins, like what holds jelly together. And there's insoluble fiber, like cellulose, like the stringy stuff in celery. Now, real fruit has both, and you need both. So the stringy stuff, the insoluble fiber, forms a latticework, like a fishnet, on the inside of your intestine. The soluble fiber, okay, plug the holes in the fishnet, and together they form an impenetrable barrier. And you need both in order to create that barrier. Think of it this way. You have a spaghetti colander, right? A metal bowl with holes in it. You run the water, water runs right through. Okay, now take a big blob of petroleum jelly, throw it into the center of the colander. Now run the water. Still runs right through, bounces off the jelly. Now take your finger and rub that jelly, petroleum jelly, all around the inside of the colander. Now run the water. Now the water doesn't run through. Now the water's captured. Now there's a barrier. So you needed three things to happen. You needed the colander, you needed the jelly, and you needed the geometry. Well, the fiber in food, in fruit, is the same thing. You need the insoluble fiber, the cellulose. You need the soluble fiber, like the pectins or the inulin, that plug the holes in that cellulose. And then you need them to work together to form a matrix on the inside of your intestine. And what that does is it forms a secondary barrier that prevents absorption of glucose, fructose, sucrose, simple starches, so that they don't go to the liver, so that the liver doesn't become overwhelmed, so that you don't end up with fatty liver and chronic metabolic disease. And if you don't absorb it early, then it goes further down the intestine where the bacteria are. And so the bacteria can chew it up for its own purposes, thus feeding the gut and keeping your bacteria happy and healthy. So fruit is good. Fruit juice is not.
I'm speaking with pediatric endocrinologist Robert Lustig. We're discussing his book, Metabolical, The Lore and Lives of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. And that's published by HarperCollins. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. His other books include The Hacking of the American Mind and Fat Chance. So let's talk about modern medicine, another of the targets of your book. Vaccines have saved countless lives during COVID, as we've seen. And to be sure, viruses operate differently than non-communicable diseases, that is, chronic diseases. But I wanted to ask you, given those wins of modern medicine, so to speak, why you think modern medicine often does more harm than good, especially in addressing chronic illness?
Well, the promise of modern medicine, and it goes way back to the 1930s, 40s. The promise of modern medicine is there's a pill for that. Okay, that we can analyze the problems of disease in such a way as to be able to target a therapy. And by doing so, we can reverse that problem by, quote, taking a pill. So here's the problem with chronic disease. There's no pill for this. So let me explain why there's no pill for this. Not because people haven't looked. Oh, they have. Not because we don't want one. We do. But it will never exist. It's not possible for it to exist. And the reason is because the targets are not druggable. So if you actually look at the molecular mechanisms of the processes that cause chronic metabolic disease, and in the book I have an entire chapter that, you know, explains the true diseases that underlie the chronic diseases. So the type 2 diabetes, the hypertension, the lipid problems, the cardiovascular disease, the cancer, the dementia, the fatty liver disease, the polycystic ovarian disease, those are not the diseases. Those are the manifestations of the diseases. The actual diseases are things you have never heard of. They're subcellular pathologies that your doctor doesn't talk to you about. They don't mention them. And the reason they don't mention them is because they don't have any drugs for them. And because there's no ICD-11 code for them. So they can't get reimbursed for them. So let me now mention to you the 8 subcellular pathologies which drive chronic metabolic disease. Here they are. 1, glycation, that Browning reaction we talked about, the Maillard reaction. 2, reactive oxygen species, oxidative stress. 3, mitochondrial dysfunction. 4, insulin resistance. 5, membrane instability. 6, inflammation. 7, methylation. And 8, autophagy. Now, how many of you out there know what any one of these 8 are? The reason you don't know what these are is because there's no pill for this. There's no pill for any of those. And that's the point. These are mitochondrial diseases. These are disorders of the mitochondria. Chronic metabolic disease is mitochondrial disease. And we have not yet figured out how to get any medicines to the mitochondria. They don't get there. We've tried, but they don't get there. We have not been able to alter mitochondrial function with drugs. The only drug that has any benefit to mitochondria that we've been able to come up with thus far is metformin. And that's one of the reasons why metformin is, 1, the first line against type 2 diabetes, appropriately so, and 2 is being used in trials to increase longevity by Dr. Nir Barzilai at Albert Einstein. And it's because of improved mitochondrial function. So the only one we have is metformin, and it's not good enough. The rest of those 8 pathologies, you know, are not being addressed in any meaningful way by any of the medicines that we have available to us. These problems are not druggable, but they are foodable.
Tell us about that.
The problem with food is it can either make your mitochondria work better or it can make your mitochondria work worse, depending on what food it is. Like, for instance, the single worst thing you can put in your body, because the single worst thing for your mitochondria are trans fats. And trans fats used to be replete throughout our entire diet for 100 years. We started putting trans fats in food back in 1911 with the advent of something called Crisco. And by 1920, it was in virtually every baked good in America. All right? This is the reason we had the 10-year-old Twinkie. So why did we put trans fats into our food? The reason is because the bacteria couldn't digest it. They didn't have the enzyme to break the trans double bond. That's true. And that's why you could have a 10-year-old Twinkie. Because no bacteria could live on that Twinkie and turn it rancid. Here's the problem. Our mitochondria are refurbished bacteria. They even have their own DNA, mitochondrial DNA. So our mitochondria don't have that enzyme either. So you would eat the trans fat, the mitochondria would try to oxidize it, try to burn it. It would get to the trans double bond. Couldn't do anything with it. It would lay it down and basically it would be like waste and would actually cause cellular dysfunction and ultimately cardiovascular disease and death. So without question, trans fats were the single worst thing you could put in your body. It took us 25 years to finally get trans fats out of food because the food industry fought back so significantly. The first report that trans fats are bad for you was in 1957. But then no one heard about them again until 1988. And then the data started accumulating slowly but surely. And finally in 2013, the FDA said, you know, this trans fat thing, it's got to stop because people are dying. Took that long to get rid of them because the food industry pushed so hard on it. Well, great, we did it. But, you know, at what cost? Turns out sugar is right behind. Sugar causes all of these deficits as well, in a slightly different way than trans fat, but nonetheless, it does it. And, you know, no one's talking at all about sugar. And, you know, sugar is a problem. We have the capacity to metabolize a little of it. We don't have the capacity to metabolize a lot of it. So there needs to be some sort of upper limit. There needs to be some sort of regulation in terms of what the food industry is allowed to do to the food. Because basically what they've done right now is poisoned it for this reason. As I've told you, ultra-processed food does not even meet the criteria for the definition of food. In fact, it meets the criteria for the definition of poison in the same way trans fats did. So what are you going to do about that?
So you're saying that the chronic illnesses that have become so widespread in the society and also around the world cannot be addressed by modern medicine because these 8 subcellular pathways are actually responsive to nutrients rather than pharmaceutical interventions. Then I guess my question is this then a question of getting the processed food out of people's diets so that they don't end up on the road to these chronic illnesses through these pathways? Or are you also saying that having non-processed food actually could correct some of these chronic diseases, all of these chronic diseases?
There is absolutely no doubt that stopping ultra-processed food and switching to real food can mitigate virtually all of these diseases. We have the data to show it. Reversal of type 2 diabetes, improvement in cognitive function, improvement in heart disease. We have the data. It's already in existence to show that if you get rid of ultra-processed food and switch to real food, you can mitigate virtually all of these chronic metabolic / mitochondrial diseases, the ones that I've mentioned, okay? Type 2, hypertension, dyslipidemia, cardiovascular disease, cancer, dementia, fatty liver disease, polycystic ovarian disease. Those 8. You can fix them by switching to a real food diet. Now, the problem is there are a lot of people, number one, who won't. And then there are a whole lot of people who can't. And they can't because they can't afford it or they can't access it. And the question is, what are we going to do about that? Well, as long as we're subsidizing all the things that make us sick, like corn, wheat, soy, sugar, don't expect things to get better. So people always ask me, well, if you had a magic wand and you could do one thing to fix the medical problem, what would you do? And my one thing would be get rid of food subsidies. Where did food subsidies come from? And the answer is they came from 1933. They came from the original Farm Bill in 1933, because we had 2 problems in this country. We had a depression and we had a Dust Bowl. And we had people in the Southwest who were dying of starvation, and we had the food in the Northeast. And the problem was we couldn't get the food from the Southwest, from the Northeast to the Southwest fast enough, because if we put it all on railroad cars and shipped it, by the time it reached the Southwest, it would be rancid. You know, the bacteria would have gotten to it, and then it would have been useless. So what we did was we basically paid the food industry to process the different components of the food, put them in 10-pound bags, put them on railroad cars, ship it to, you know, Arizona, Kansas, etc., in the middle of the Dust Bowl, bake it up there, and we saved the population. And, you know, that made sense, and those were the first subsidies. And that actually made sense all the way through World War II. But after World War II, that policy did not make sense anymore. But people had learned, oh, we can make money at this. There's money to be made. There's an entire industry here. And so what did we do? We doubled down. And so that really started food processing. And then in 1971, Richard Nixon, carrying on Johnson's war against poverty, told his agriculture secretary, Earl Butz, make food cheap. And the reason he said that was because he knew that fluctuating food prices cause political unrest. And he had a whole lot of political unrest to deal with. And so Earl Butz went to the middle of the heartland, to Nebraska and to Kansas, to Iowa, and he said three things. He said, row to row, furrow to furrow, get bigger, get out. And that paved the way to a new industrial food paradigm called monoculture. And so that's why all of the cattle got moved to Kansas and all the corn and the soybeans ended up in Iowa. All right. And the problem is that the cattle used to graze on the clover and the alfalfa, and they used to get the omega-3s that they needed to be immune suppressive and antibacterial. The problem is now they're sitting in Kansas eating the corn and getting sick on the omega-6s and lying in their own excrement because their manure used to be the fertilizer, but now it's got no place to go except, you know, on them, them lying around in their own excrement. So they would get, you know, gastrointestinal diseases, enteritis, cholera, et cetera. And so we had to start giving the cattle antibiotics in order to keep them alive. And back in Iowa, we've got the corn and the soybeans, you know, now in monoculture. And the problem is, what's the fertilizer? The cows left. So they started spraying nitrogen fertilizer on everything. The problem is that causes nitrogen runoff, causes nitric oxide, which increases problems of climate change because nitrous oxide is so heat trapping. You know, people make such a big deal about methane. Okay, nitrous oxide is 1,000 times worse and in much higher concentration than methane. You know, everyone wants to kill the cows, get rid of the cows. In fact, the nitrogen fertilizer is a much bigger deal because it has a higher heat trapping capacity than methane, 9 times higher. It has a higher residence time in the atmosphere, 114 years versus 9 years. All right. And there's more of it because all of this nitrogen fertilizer that has to be sprayed. So this is the reason for the dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico from the runoff from Iowa. That's why there's no fish left in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's why, you know, we have such a huge climate change problem is because we took the cows and moved them to Kansas. So all of these things are interrelated, all in the name of processed food.
Well, clearly, as you're delineating, the effects of processed food and more broadly, ill health affect the society as a whole, including in sort of narrowly economic measures, lost productivity, medical costs. Yet you argue that the U.S. government benefits from the good fortunes of the processed food company as well as the pharmaceuticals companies. How so?
Well, they have tariffs. You know, we sell this stuff abroad. And so the federal government makes $56 billion a year on tariffs on ultra-processed food that we sell elsewhere. So, you know, it's their gravy train too. The problem is that we spend so much on healthcare. Think of it, the government thinks that these are siloed, that these aren't separate problems. They're not. They're interlinked. So think of it this way. The processed food industry in America grosses $1.5 trillion a year, of which 45% is gross profit. So that's a $700 billion a year gross profit to the food industry. That's how much money they make. But healthcare in America costs $3.8 trillion a year, of which 75% is chronic metabolic disease, the diseases I mentioned. And of that, 75% of that could be mitigated, could be obviated, if we could return to levels that were prior to our processed food debacle, say the levels of 1970. So 75% of the chronic disease is preventable and recoupable in terms of cost. So 75% of 75% of $3.8 trillion is $1.9 trillion a year going down a rat hole. The food industry makes $700 billion. We lose $1.9 trillion cleaning up their mess. That is unsustainable. And it will continue to be unsustainable until we do something about the food.
You argue that evidence indicates that sugar is addictive, and it's even more addictive when it's combined with caffeine, as in soda. So if that's the case, then what can be done to reduce Americans' habit? You're talking about all of these structural forces in place, including government complicity, that benefit from having Americans eat processed food. And for many people, it's something they will struggle to stop eating. So what can be done?
That's a very good question. Extremely good question. What do you do about addiction? You know, there is a branch of medicine, you know, called addiction medicine, where we are able to do that. All right. You know, people do come off opioids. People do come off alcohol. People do come off nicotine. In order for them to do so, though, we need two, not one, we need two separate structures. We need personal intervention, which for lack of a better word, we can call rehab. And we need societal intervention, which for lack of a better word, we can call laws. We have rehab and laws for nicotine, alcohol, street drugs, opioids, heroin, right? We have rehab and laws for all of those. For sugar, we have nothing. We need both. We need rehab. We need sugar rehab, right? Point is that insurance companies won't even pay dietitians to see a patient. Why not? Number two, we need laws. Well, what kind of laws are we talking about? Well, maybe regulation about how much sugar, for instance, could be in any specific food to make sure that the food industry doesn't gouge, and stays within guidelines, right? An example is children's cereals, right? How much sugar should be in a children's cereal? Well, Kellogg's Honey Smacks is 56% sugar. That's the worst. Fruit Loops, which is on the National School Breakfast Program, is number 10 at 41%. Now, we've known this for a long time, and we've exposed this, and the Environmental Working Group actually did an analysis of this back in 2011 and pointed this out. And do you think Kellogg's changed its recipe? It's the same today. So why can't we determine what the right amount should be and have the industry stick to it and have all of the players play by the same rules so that there's no competitive advantage? I'll give you an example. In Britain, they had a huge problem with hypertension and stroke. And the reason was the salt content of the food. In 2006, the Blair government sat down with all of the major players in the British food industry, so Tesco, Waitrose, Marks and Spencer, etc. And they said, we're all going to play together and we're not going to tell the population, but you are going to reduce the sodium content of your individual foods by 10% per year over the course of 3 years to get down to a reduction of 30%. And we're not going to tell anybody. We're just going to do it. And no one will notice. And indeed, no one noticed. And they got the sodium content down by 30%. And in 2011, a paper was published showing that the British population had a reduction in hypertension and stroke by 40% because of it. So a public health maneuver by addressing the food supply, by what was wrong with the food supply, where everyone was a winner, including the food industry. It can be done, but you need government to play referee. The point is, our government doesn't even understand that they are the referee.
Well, let me end by asking you about schools. You just mentioned children's food, and of course, one place that the government can very easily have an effect is over what children consume in public schools. How do you see the situation of schools?
So I am the chief science officer of a nonprofit here in the Bay Area called Eat Real. All right, and what we do is we fix the food in schools, K to 12. So think of it this way. Every school today relies on the food coming in from Sysco or McDonald's or some purveyor because they don't have the capacity to make the food in schools, to prepare the food in schools, because all of the food service preparation facilities have been turned into classrooms. And this happened back in the 1970s because the food industry said, we can supply you with food at a cheaper rate, and you can then recoup that infrastructure and use it for classrooms, which every school needed. Well, that was their plan, because what that did was that, you know, made the schools hostage to the food industry for the rest of their existence. It basically made them addicts, because they now relied on those companies to be able to bring the food in. Well, we have gotten rid of 270,000 pounds of sugar out of the Mount Diablo Unified School District in 1 year. 10 pounds per student, because we're making the food. And guess what? It's cheaper. Implement this, and we can do this for any school district. And so if you're interested in this, you know, it's called eatreal.org. See what we're doing. See how we can help your school district. And we'd be delighted to help move this statewide and nationally.
Robert Lustig, thank you so much.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you very much, Sasha.
I've been speaking with Emeritus Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology at UCSF. Robert Lustig is the author of Metabolical, The Lure and Lies of Processed Food, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. His other books include The Hacking of the American Mind and Fat Chance. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.